Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Window. This is our Group F preview for the World Cup. We've got representatives from the four nations in Group F: Croatia, Belgium, Morocco, and Canada. This is an interesting group. This is a group that we're not sure how it's ultimately going to shake out. Belgium might be the favorite going in. I think a lot of people would think Croatia also is a team that is going to make noise at the World Cup. But Canada and Morocco also are playing really well. Canada topped the group in qualifying from CONCACAF. Morocco certainly deserving to be at the World Cup and one of the better African nations. So wanted to start by just introducing our co-hosts and letting them tell you about who they are and where you can find them on social media. So Adam, let's start with you.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Adam Jenkins. I'm a on-air talent for One Soccer. I primarily do play-by-play for the Canadian Premier League and the Canadian Women's National Team and a lot of sideline for the Men's National Team. So I'm fairly well-versed in the world of Canadian football, and we're just finishing up a CPL season. We have a couple of Women's National Team friendlies their last of the year, and then we'll be all focused on what John Herdman's men are going to try and do in Qatar.
Awesome. Benja, let's go to you next.
My name is Benjamin Hatchie. I live in Norway, but I have a Moroccan heritage. My parents are Moroccan, so it was natural for me to follow the Moroccan national team. I run the media platform Maghreb Foot, which is a platform dedicated to Moroccan football. Also done some scouting as well with focus on Moroccan players in the local league. So very excited to be here with you guys and to hear all about our opponents of the upcoming World Cup.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. Lovre, let's go to you next.
My name is Lovre Nikolac. I'm based in a little town in Ploče in Croatia. I run the Croatia Footy account, and I'm the host of the Croatian Football Podcast.
Awesome. Thank you for joining us. And Elliot, let's go to you.
Yes, my name is Elliot Ingendrian Verstraten. I'm half Belgian, half Swedish. Currently live in the Netherlands. And I write a little bit about Belgian football on a Swedish website. And yeah, I mean, that's me.
Awesome. Thank you all for joining us. So we're going to get into it and talk a little bit about this group that, for me, is certainly one of the groups that I'm looking forward to most, because I think it's one of the most unpredictable. I think Group B with England, USA, Wales, Iran is certainly a group that you're not necessarily certain what to expect. But this group also, I feel, is up there in terms of groups that we could see all four teams progress. Adam, I wanted to start with you because Canada is a nation that I think people are writing off a little bit. And when you look at what they've accomplished in World Cup qualifying, they topped the qualifying octagonal. They defeated Mexico. They finished ahead of the USA. Do you think Canada is being underrated a little bit headed into the World Cup?
I think if you were to say to John Herdman that there were no expectations for the group, he'd probably love that, and he would feel like his messaging and the way they've been trying to own the underdog story was working. Brennan, you need to understand that this is a sensitive 24 hours for Canadian football supporters right now the gasp that the country collectively let out when Alphonso Davies pulled up with his hamstring yesterday. Bayern did update everyone that he is not expected to be missing the World Cup, but that does not mean he's going to be at 100%. So that alone, the talisman, the number one Canadian footballer, the most popular Canadian athlete in the world, everyone is nervous. And then we lose our backup goalkeeper, Maxime Crépeau, last night in the MLS Cup final with what we know is a nasty leg injury. We don't know to the extent. He got his MLS Cup medal in the hospital room, so that's probably a pretty good visual that we're not going to have his services available. But Dane St. Clair should back up Milan Borjan just fine, and it was always going to be Milan's net. In terms of the group as a whole, I think they have to be underdogs because it's been probably, and I don't profess to know everyone's date of birth here, but I don't think any of us have been alive the last time that Canada was in a World Cup. So of course they should be an underdog. Of course they should be proud of what they accomplished in CONCACAF qualifying, but until they do it on the world stage, there is not enough to say Canada should be a betting favorite in any capacity to get out of the group. Having said that, what this team has done exceptionally well from the very beginning is overachieve and prove people wrong. I think when it was announced that Canada was going to co-host the 2026 World Cup with the Americans, with the Mexicans, I think the soccer community here sort of circled 26 as the year where they wanted to see this team hit its stride. And I still think that's true. But within that, I think it took a lot of the pressure off of them in World Cup qualifying. Got to remember, too, that with originally, they were going, CONCACAF was just going to condense it and not go through this big octagonal system that it became. And Canada wasn't even going to have a shot to qualify. And then they did end up expanding it. And Canada had to go through the Cayman Islands and all of these pre-octagonal qualifiers just to get there. And that really brought the team together. They're in a state of transition where you can tell that there are some leaders that are at the end and this will be their last go. So that's why you really feel for the likes of Atiba Hutchinson, who felt like he was the talisman. He was the one that everyone wanted to win for. But then you do have this incredibly exciting crop of young players. There's no denying the star power of Alphonso Davies, of Jonathan David, of Kyle Larin, and even Stefan Eustachio, who's doing incredible things for Porto right now, especially in Champions League. So there are really good pieces. And what makes this team difficult to beat is the names that don't jump out at you when you look at the team sheet are quality, and they bought into John Herdman's system. So it's going to be a case of how that first game goes, who's fit. A lot of the MLS-based players are out of season now. All of them are, now that MLS Cup is over, but some of them, especially CF Montreal, having that early exit, but that big like Canadian five contingent who play for the national team out a little bit earlier. So they're in Bahrain right now preparing for that friendly. They'll have Japan in Dubai, and then Belgium will be here before you know it. So I like the way you frame it, Brandon, and that, to me, I totally agree. This is the group that you can't predict. Canada could go two wins, no losses, and a draw. Wouldn't surprise me. Canada could lose every single game and not score a goal. It wouldn't surprise me. To me, it's that open. I just think that there is this excitement that they seem ahead of schedule. And regardless of how 22 goes, that experience for so many of the young players is going to be so invaluable for the next cycle when they co-host.
Yeah. And I think this is a bit of a layup here, but what do you think of what John Herdman has done with the national team? Because you look at the USA and Mexico and CONCACAF, and from a managerial perspective, typically you're hearing a lot of accolades and praise for John Herdman. You don't necessarily hear that with the USA and Mexico. What do you think of the job that John Herdman has done thus far?
Yeah, John's done a fantastic job, and he deserves a lot of the credit and the praise that he's been given. I think should he ever decide football, he's done with football, he could run for politics. So there might be a next UK Prime Minister, John Herdman. He's that kind of person. He knows how to spin. He knows public relations. He knows the entire business of it, and he's very good at it. Football-wise, I think he is an incredible tactician. I think anyone who never played the game on a professional level, never had the international caps, they have that chip on their shoulder that they have to try and be the smartest person in the room to get other people to show them the respect that typically just comes with, oh, he's played, he gets it. So John needed to take that different path from New Zealand and obviously the academies that he coached in England before coming to the women's national team, now the men's national team. The most impressive thing that he has done is got the group together. Like this, I don't want to make any illusions. This was a fractured team. This was football or soccer in Canada, save for the diehards who were probably have or second generation Canadians, or their parents were born in a different country and loved a certain team, a certain country. That's where like the true support came. And the women's national team here has done wonders with their bronze medals back to back and then gold. That pushes the needle, having the CPL. But the men's national team, you would watch because you expected a train wreck if you weren't a diehard supporter. I mean, 8-1 is the obvious. It's the layup, to use that turn of phrase you just used. But what John did is he came into the group and he ruffled some feathers when he left the women's national team before they accomplished their goals. But it was a big project for him, and he got everyone to buy in. And now you hear the cliche brotherhood and unity over and over and over again, and they truly do play for each other. So without him, I don't think Canada is in this position, and I don't know that anybody in the world of Canadian soccer holds more power than John Herdman. I think you look at the men's national team right through to a lot of similarities. Bev Priestman is almost a carbon copy of John in terms of how they think, in terms of how they want to build their systems, and the youth pyramid here tries to play the same way. that doesn't necessarily lead to a ton of success in youth competitions, as we've seen, especially this year. But what it does is it makes the players that stand out easy to plug and play into that next level because everyone understands their role. So now that we're coming into an era where there's dual nationals coming over, and if Canada does moderately well, there will be more people who think maybe this is my path to a World Cup or international acclaim. I think that he deserves the credit in that sense for bringing everyone together and just making the country believe again, because it hasn't believed in the team in a very long time.
Canada's a team whose arrow is definitely pointing up. I wanted to go to Lovry because Croatia is another team that they won their group in the UEFA Nations League. They're going to be in the Nations League finals. It looked like it was going to be Denmark for a while, but they finished ahead of both Denmark and France. So another team with an arrow really pointing up. What are your expectations coming into this tournament for this group, knowing how well they are playing right now?
Oh, they are high, but I like to be a realist, so I kind of like to keep it low, but still high. But especially that Nations League campaign, it didn't start off well. We lost 3-0 to Austria at home. And that time, we just looked awful. That game, we had a couple of chances, but not how we are supposed to look. But afterwards, a draw to France, beat France for the first time ever in our history, beat Denmark twice, and then beat Austria in the final match to get into the final four. It was just an amazing campaign, especially what you want before a big World Cup as this one is. So Zlatko Dalic has got the men really ramped up. The new players who haven't played at a World Cup before have looked really good, as we have changed the squad a lot. The old players we're missing, Mandžukić. Still, we haven't found the right replacement for Mandžukić at the striker position, but we have a few good options. And we've gotten rid of a problem that we had at fullback positions, at the left and right back positions. We didn't have that good of players, but now we have players playing at high level clubs and playing at Champions League and Europa League level, which is amazing. So we're really on a high. So I'm really expecting a lot, a quarter final at least.
Can I ask a question, Brandon?
Is that okay? Of course.
I wanted to ask, Lovro, I'm very curious about Croatia and how they stand ahead of this World Cup compared to 2018, both in terms of the players in the squad and also the form of Croatia going into this World Cup. Can you say anything about that? How they look now?
I remember the 2018 campaign for the qualifying campaign was stressful. This one for the 2022 World Cup was also stressful, but in 2017 we had to go through the playoffs to get to the World Cup. We had to beat Ukraine, and we finished behind Iceland in our qualifying group when we were predicted to finish first. So that time I wasn't feeling that much hopeful as I am now, but especially, I mean, we got to the final in that World Cup, so of course, you have some more expectations have risen from that, but just that qualifying campaign, getting through the playoffs, it just didn't feel right for us. But we did get there eventually. But then we got a group with Argentina, and when you saw that, it wasn't that good. But now we have basically Belgium in that sort of name, that big name in your group. But the hopes are bigger than they were in 2018, and we more calmly, even though we had to beat Russia in the last game to get. To get automatically to Qatar, but there were a few games in the squad campaign for Qatar that were questionable, but near the end we found the right system, the right players for the system. Dalic motivated them, and we looked amazing, and we still look amazing. So that we're definitely better than 2018, I think, quality wise. Now we're gonna see if we're better as a team.
You mentioned some interesting points that happened since the last World Cup, and that in World Cup qualifying for Qatar, things started off slowly. In the UEFA Nations League, things started off slowly. And typically with nations, you will see peaks and valleys as some of the players get older, younger players are brought into the team. But Croatia has gone through that much more quickly than you typically see, where after the World Cup, things did get a bit worse, but things turned around very quickly. Who do you think is really responsible for getting Croatia back on track and feeling like you said, a quarterfinal at least?
I don't think you can directly give it to somebody. It has to be just Modric and Brozovic, who were already there, and then you count Dalic that were in that 2018 squad. Now welcomed all the new players that got them, that basically got their mindset in the right space for matches, especially in the Euros. We also didn't get a good start to the Euros. We lost to England, then we drew to the Czech Republic, and then we beat Scotland in a very good match, and then we had a really, really great battle with Spain in the round of 16, which sadly ended in a 5-3 loss. But Dalic and just the old guys that were at the 2018 World Cup that welcomed the new players, that got them introduced with everybody. So I think Dalic and Modric especially were definitely the main ones.
Yeah, Luka Modric is still a world-class player for sure. Benji, I wanted to go to you as well, because speaking of change and new things coming into the team, the manager of Morocco is going to be new. What are your thoughts about that change? Because I know Joe was probably going to ask about that as well. That's been a highly publicized change, and it really felt for a while like it was something that was coming and inevitable. What do you think of that change for Morocco?
Yeah, I was going to say that as well. I think we are probably, I haven't looked at all the other national teams, but I assume that we are one of very few who changed our head coach a couple of months before the World Cup. I've had a lot of opinions on this topic before, and I'm trying to not make it too long. But for me, I personally was against the decision to sack the coach to begin with. As we remember, it was Vahid Halilhodžić, who was the former head coach of Morocco. He led them in the World Cup qualifiers. Well, he did manage to qualify Morocco to the World Cup, which was an achievement in itself. He was there at the 2021, sorry, Africa Cup of Nations, where they went out to Egypt in the quarterfinals. So results-wise, he did quite well. He had the results on his side, and he's been speaking about this later as well. That, you know, statistically, he's one of the best coaches Morocco has had in terms of results alone. But the issue for Halilhodžić has been in previous national teams as well. He has struggled to get along with key players, especially, which has been an issue. You know, he's a very stubborn coach who likes to have things in his own way. And, you know, in Morocco especially, we have a couple of players who I think didn't feel right under the system with Halilhodžić. He had problems with Hakim Ziyech. He had problems with Nusser Mazraoui, you know, two players who play at Chelsea and Bayern Munich respectively. And both were out of the squad for quite some time. And Hakim Ziyech even retired from the national team under that head coach. So pressure was starting to build against the head coach, because fans in Morocco, I think Hakim Ziyech is probably the most popular player among Moroccan fans, you know. So when he decided to retire and you know, in a way, turn fans against the coach, it looked increasingly like he was on borrowed time, you know. We had a friendly against the United States in the summer where we lost, I think, 3-0, which again started to mount pressure on him. And eventually, the federation made a decision that either we stick with the coach and we know that key players will be missing, or we sack the coach and hope that those players will return. And that's what they did in the end. Halilhodžić was fired, and Hakim Ziyech and Mazraoui came in immediately alongside Amin Harit of Marseille, and we appointed Walid Regragui. It was, I think, what we needed, kind of, when the decision was made to sack Halilhodžić. I think Regragui was what Morocco needed, because he is he's a product of European football in terms of the fact that he is born in France, you know, has played his football in France for long parts of his career. He is a former Morocco international. He was part of the 2004 Africa Cup of Nations finalist team. He has been an assistant before in the national team setup, and not to mention the fact that he has been successful in the local league. You know, I think that was important for a lot of Moroccan fans, especially those fans who feel that the local-based players aren't being looked at. I think it was important to bring in a coach who has had success domestically. He won the league with Wydad Casablanca. He also won the Champions League in Africa with Wydad Casablanca. So, you know, he has a pedigree in terms of his merits. And he's a guy who's able to, I think, get along with both the European based players and the local based players. So yeah, there is, I would say generally there's optimism among Moroccan fans, although some people like me were against the decision to begin with. But now that we're here, I think people accepted it and are content, especially with the fact that we have our best players on paper back in the squad.
I think it's always a tough balance trying to decide, do we stick with the coach that got us here or do we sack him, get the players back into the squad? Because ultimately the players are the players, and not having them in, and to your point, Hakim Ziyech is a fan favorite, and him not being there, it's something that Joe and I have talked about on podcasts previously as well. And we were really curious to see which direction that would head. Are you concerned about timing? So as you mentioned, there are not many, and I also don't know the exact answer of how many of the 32 teams have made a coaching change right before the World Cup. Are you concerned with the timing of being able to implement a system in that tight of a time frame with the World Cup so close?
Yeah, for sure. And that was one of my concerns, timing, especially, you know, because I thought that if we, because this has been looming for a while, you know, people have been discussing this for a long time. So I was questioning the fact that we didn't do this sooner if this was the decision that the Federation wanted to go with. Personally, the reason why it didn't sit well with me was not necessarily because I liked Halil Hodžić as a coach or tactically or the way his style of football. It was just more the fact that when you decide to sack a manager because of his decision to leave players out, I think it begs the question who really has the power, you know, inside the Federation, inside the dressing room. If a player can decide to stay home and internationally retire and refuse to be called up, because Hakim Ziyech did get called up eventually under Vahid when the coach was forced by the Federation to call up the best players. But both Ziyech and Mazraoui at one point turned down the call up, again building pressure against the coach. So I thought it was, I don't know if I'm to say cowardly, but I thought it was a bit strange that they decided to go and pick the side of the players instead of the coach. And yeah, like you said, the timing as well, because now the head coach only has a few months for the team to prepare. He's already switched the formation, the preferred formation of the team. But I don't think that necessarily has to be a bad thing, you know, because I think when you get in a coach with a social amount of time, at least we will have a lifted spirit and some optimism inside the team. You know, we saw that in the September friendlies, although we didn't play too well against Paraguay, in the friendly against Chile, which we won 2-0. Morocco were brilliant, you know, and it was typically of a team that has just appointed a new coach, a lot of energy, high pressure, people running for the ball, you know, even the top players usually doesn't track back, you know, are fighting for every ball. And I think that's a symptom of a team that has been getting a new coach and getting them fired up, and a team that wanted to prove themselves and wanted to prove the Federation right for making that decision, and also to impress the fans and convince them that this is the right way to go. So, in general, I think it's when it came down to that point, I think it was okay to make that decision, and I think we will go in with a lot of optimism, high spirits, and hopefully a united team.
Yeah, Morocco is definitely a team that I'm going to have my eye on. I wanted to go over to Elliot. Haven't gotten to you yet, but want to talk about Belgium a little bit. And Belgium is a team that, as we've gone through some of these previews, people don't seem to be very high on. The expectations around Belgium, obviously the world-class players throughout the roster, and Belgium's been at the top of Europe, at the top of the world, really, in the top five of the rankings for a very long time, and has not seemed to get over that hump and really ultimately win a tournament. What are your expectations for Belgium coming into this tournament, knowing a lot of the players are getting a little bit older, but still a very, very good squad?
Yeah, I think it's difficult in this group, especially, to have expectations further on in the World Cup because of the group next to us being a group that includes both Spain and Germany. Because that means that you can win the group and then still probably face Spain or Germany, which are teams that have the potential to go on and win the entire World Cup. So it's difficult for me to have expectations beyond the first knockout round, really. The expectation, I would say, is to at least finish in the top two. I would say that it is probably not a big difference to finish first or second in this group, and then to put in a good performance in the first knockout round. If you get beaten with a lot of goals in the first knockout round, then of course it's not going to be an acceptable tournament for Belgium. However, if you put in a really good performance, maybe get unlucky and get knocked out by Spain or Germany, it's also going to be very difficult to be too harsh on the team. But yeah, for sure, you mentioned that people are not as high in Belgium coming into this tournament compared to maybe the last two tournaments that Belgium has played, being the Euros and the World Cup. And I completely agree, and I can really see why. Last World Cup, we had a lot of players in their prime, a lot of players performing really well for their clubs. And since that tournament, really, a lot of players haven't performed as well. You've seen, for example, Eden Hazard completely failing at Real Madrid. You've seen Romelu Lukaku, who has had spells of really good form since then. For example, his first tenure at Inter Milan. But now, for example, he's back injured. He came from a difficult spell at Chelsea, and you don't really know where you have him. And then players are also getting older. Looking at our back line, you can clearly see that they will have problems facing quicker opposition, especially. And I think most Belgians would have hoped that the generation shift would have gone quicker and smoother. I don't think a lot of people would have thought that we would be standing here looking at both Alderweireld and Vertonghen in the starting 11 going into this World Cup. But ultimately, the center backs that had opportunities next to them has not performed, and they've ultimately been going into this World Cup. They are the two center backs that I'm the most sure of is going to start, and the third position is the one that I don't know who's going to be, which says a lot about how the generation shift has gone and why we're no longer at the top of the world rankings and why people do not think Belgium had the potential to win this World Cup.
Do you expect any newer players or perhaps some names that people might not be as familiar with that might make it into the squad for Belgium? I think my expectation is consistent with yours in that they're going to run back a lot of the players you've seen before in past tournaments, and their level of play at this point in time is probably not at the same level that it was before. And so that makes me a little bit concerned for Belgium. But do you think there's anybody that could surprise and really have a strong tournament in Qatar?
In terms of surprises, it's difficult to say. It's also difficult for certain positions to know who Roberto Martinez is going to choose. In the Nations League, in the last couple of games, he went for Seno de Bast, a very young center back, to be the third center back next to Alderweireld and Vertonghen. I think you saw promising signs. He's very comfortable with the ball. You also saw that he can get bullied by opposition players, especially in the air, which I think is a pretty big issue. And we conceded goals both against Wales and the Netherlands because of it last time. So I'm not sure if he's going to risk it and go for such a young player, inexperienced player in the World Cup. He might get a chance in the squad, but I don't think he should, and I don't think he will start in the World Cup. Other than that, he's not a new player at all, but I think Yuri Tielemans could have a breakout tournament if he gets the chance. That's also a bit 50-50 if Roberto Martinez is going to go for Tielemans or Amadou Onana, who has been very good when he's gotten the chance in both Belgium this season, but also at Everton. He's looked really bright and another young talent. He might also have his breakout tournament. Then, other than that, maybe players off the bench. I don't see any other really young players getting into the starting 11. You might see players like Charles de Ketelaar get chances off the bench, and he's a very good player. But yeah, it is. I think the younger players will get their chance after the World Cup mostly. You will see probably players like Witsel, Alderweireld, Vertonghen. This might be their last tournament. I think Kevin De Bruyne and Lukaku, they're not getting younger, but they, if they still want to continue playing, they will be good enough to get into the first team. But building around them and trying new players until the next Euros is probably the way to go. I think it's too late now for Belgium to try new players in this World Cup.
Yeah, and even with those players, there seems to be some pessimism or an understanding that things are trending a little bit downward. But I wanted to come back to Adam because I think if you're looking at the Canada roster and then looking at Belgium, I think you're not feeling any of that. This is a team that's there for the taking. They're on the way down or anything along those lines. How do you think Canada lines up against the other three teams in this group?
Yeah, I think we've seen Canada show at times. They're a very adaptable group. I will admit, when the draw came out, I think Canada was, as a country, was so excited just to see our name on the little piece of paper that they're like, what are the easiest narratives and laziest storylines we can latch on to for hope? So you go Belgium, old, Croatia, yeah. old, Morocco, who? And that was just like the general vibe in the country, which is obviously not true and not fair in any capacity. Absolutely. So about a month later, we came back to earth a little bit and understood this is a really hard group. Having said that, the one thing that I think the draw did a very big favor for Canada in is the schedule. I don't think I would change the order of the matches for Canada whatsoever. Mm. I think John and his staff are probably putting in 90-hour weeks and have been from the draw just to figure out how to beat Belgium. Croatia feels like the scheduled loss because Croatia is, in my opinion, likely the favorite to win the group, and then it's all to play for Morocco. So I think that the schedule wise that way is best case. Belgium, I think, as Elliot rightfully alludes to, it just seems like there is this pressure on them, which isn't fair. I think they're the most perennially slept on team in the world. And you'll probably see the Welsh shirt behind me. That's the other side of my family heritage. So I've seen a lot of Belgium. I'm kind of sick of them, kind of sick of the idea of seeing Belgium and Canada in the World Cup, but at least I know them at this point. But I think it's a game where the speed of Canada, and I think everyone in the top four, top five can just run laps. And I think if there's going to be a goal, maybe a few goals, like a 2-1 Canada would be best case scenario. But the roster, I think the midfield, depending on whether or not Scott Arfield comes back, which I think is a question that a lot of people are asking with seemingly Canada's fragility in health right now. He and John Herdman do not get along. That is not the public version why he is not in the team anymore and why he called it quits. But there was definitely a rift there, and Scott just decided there were better things to focus on, in his case, continuing to dominate in Scotland. So if somehow that bridge can be mended, I think Canada has a really, really strong midfield. And yes, Alfonso and Jonathan and Kyle get a lot of headlines, as they should, Junior Hoilett as well. But I think, like he did in the last men's Olympic qualifying tournament, Tayshaun Buchanan is going to surprise a lot of people. I think he is one of the diamonds on this roster. I think he is not close to a complete player yet, but he has shown that while he can be a bit of a hothead and he needs to be refined more, there is so much potential in that kid as like an Alfonso Davies kind of understudy, in that once the team hits where they think they can be, you kind of have both of them in like a free role, and it allows them to do whatever they want in that sense. The issue for Canada, it has been, it will be for a little while, is the back line as well. So I think for Canada to have success, they need Milan Borjan to maybe be a Golden Glove nominee by the end of the tournament, and they need that back five to just buy in and love and want to suffer. Alistair Johnston, probably not a name that is very familiar outside of Canada. He is like the story that everyone, he's just the nerdiest athlete I've ever met in my life, and I adore him for that. He is brilliant. He just does everything right. He's like that guy that doesn't want the spotlight. He goes to work, puts his hard hat on, and does whatever you ask him to do. And he is that guy that likes the suffering. And he had a big move going to Nashville, now playing in Montreal with some of his teammates. A lot of the Canadian backline plays together at CF Montreal, and we've seen that team succeed in the MLS regular season. We've seen them come together and grow into themselves a little bit. So I think if they can be near perfect, which they're going to need to be to have a chance, it doesn't matter if you think that Belgium should be your win. It doesn't mean it's going to be. it's going to be very interesting how that first game goes. But I think everything is in place if we can just put everyone in bubble wrap. I don't want them to play friendlies. I will take fitness over form at this point. I'm still scarred from yesterday, and I will be until that ball is kicked for the first time. I just think that there's a reason why there's this mood with Canada where everyone's like, that's the hipster pick. They're fun. They're exciting. Alphonso Davies is wearing Crocs and doing TikToks and wearing Tyrannosaurus Rex Halloween costumes. Like, they're just a fun team to be around, and John Herdman is the likable guy. So the pieces are there for them to do something. It's just, as these podcasts and panels of predictions always are, it's all speculation until we see it in action and how they adjust to playing Qatar in the heat and where everyone is at that point in their season.
So can I just ask Adam kind of a different sort of question? We were both really excited that Canada qualified and really pleased that they qualified in their own right ahead of co-hosting in 2026. And so I'm just curious to know, you know, and this is maybe an obvious question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. You know, what is the vibe in Canada right now? Like, how has it been since that was confirmed that you guys qualified? Like, and what kind of preparations are going in across the country in terms of like celebrations or fan gatherings or whatever ahead of this?
Yeah, there's two distinct answers to this question. The off-field life right now with Canada soccer is a bit messy. I think some people know that the players, both the men's and women's team, are trying to get their contract negotiated. They were hoping that they'd have the World Cup as their leverage. It has not worked. It doesn't seem like it's particularly close, and I would be shocked if anything gets done before the World Cup. So there's this weird dichotomy where the supporters and the football side, everyone is elated. And Canada is a massive country. It's very wide. It's tough to get from one coast to the other. So it's not going to be that everyone gathers in Toronto and has a big party. It's like Vancouver's going to be a hotspot. Then you have Calgary and Edmonton and all the main city centers. And within each, when you break Canada down sort of province by province, there is a lot of dual nationals. So I think what a lot of football supporters are excited about is, for a lot of them, there's two teams to support, unless you're Italian, which we have a lot of, and that makes me very happy. that is a joke to one of my co-hosts at One Soccer. But I think there's just an excited vibe, but they're... We can't talk about the World Cup without acknowledging that there is a rift between leadership and players. And obviously there was the postponed friendly. There was the chaos in that window when Nations League started. They played Curacao, but they had to postpone, and there were fines. Iran was another big debacle from the association and how it all unwound when the government got involved. I think they've been so busy with other sports in Canada that have their own problems right now, that when they put their finger on the pulse of Canadian football, Canadian soccer, everyone's like, oh, you are paying attention. So that side exists, and I think it's just going to sort of hover, not like a big dark cloud, but it's worth being mindful of. But I think a lot of people who have been diehard supporters of this team are just excited at the chance to see their team in the World Cup for the very first time. So I think if Canada scores a goal, which they did not do in 1986, that is a victory. And then from there, it's gravy, it's all bonus. But at the same time, from all the success we've seen and the hype, I think the Canadian general supporter that is typically used to being the underdog kind of wants that coming of age party moment and like showing the world that we're not just Alphonso Davies, that this is a good team. And this is a good team that's not going anywhere, because while there are some teams, as you guys have rightly pointed out, with Belgium and Croatia especially, that feel like they're sort of on the other side of their success, Canada's just at the very beginning of it. So I think it's a very exciting time to be there. And the fact that this group is going to be chaotic is brilliant to me. I love chaos.
So can I follow up with a question for Benji, actually? So I was at the Morocco game when they played the US. That was here in my home city. And one of the things I noticed actually was when the tide turned and you know, the US kind of took a dominating lead, there was some frustration amongst the players in the squad. And I think that's fair for any squad, honestly, you know, to be frustrated at maybe a scoreline like that. But are you concerned about that at all? And is the coach trying to help kind of bond this team a little more? And I'll point out a name. So the player that stood out to me the most actually was Hakimi, because first of all, I love him. I think he's a fantastic player, and he was, you know, bombing forward, but I felt like he was trying to do too much. And then he was kind of shifting some of the blame on the rest of his teammates because he was trying to do too much. So do you have you ever had that sort of same sense at all? And, you know, is that going to be an issue?
It's a good question. And it's hard. I think it's hard for, especially for national teams where you really have one specific, you know, star player who needs and has to be given a lot of responsibility. In the US match, it's a tough one because this was the last this was the last camp with the former coach. So, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, pressure was really starting to build at that point. So, and I think maybe that got to the players as well, you know, because they're at the US game. I'm not sure if you noticed, but there were boos from the Moroccan fans. There were shouts for the manager to be sacked, you know. So the atmosphere was bad at that point towards the head coach. And I assume that also got to the players a little bit. Not that they turned against the coach, but, you know, they can feel that. They can feel that atmosphere among the crowd. And when, you know, to be fair to the US, they were excellent in that game. They were very, very good. So, you know, when the goals started to come in, I think that just transmitted onto the players, and they did look stressed and a bit frustrated. I hope that is something that we can put behind us. We did play two AFCON qualification matches after that game where we did do slightly better, and we have now changed coach as well. So I hope that shouldn't play any part, and, you know, fans and players seem more aligned with each other now. So, like I said earlier, there's more optimism. In terms of Hakimi, he was amazing at the recent AFCON. You know, he scored some crucial goals from set pieces, and, you know, he was generally the leader that we wanted him to be. You know, he's still very young, but he's on the path of becoming the most capped Morocco player of all time. You know, getting his debut at 18, 19 years old, he's already played at the World Cup. Split at two or three AFCONs already. So, you know, we do need him. And under the previous coach, the formation and the system was very much based on him, you know, against the US as well. And at the AFCON previously, we have played in a 3-5-2, which is obviously because we have Hakimi, and for us to get the most out of him, we have to line up in a wing back formation. I'm not sure if that's what Canada does with Davis too, but we can ask Adam about that later. But yeah, we did play a 3-5-2, so Hakimi has a lot of responsibility on that wing back, but he has the whole wing to himself, and I think that can play against him sometimes, you know, especially internationally where our opponents will obviously look to him as the biggest threat, and they will double down on him. And then, you know, when things are not going his way, when there's so much expectations put on his shoulders, I think it can become challenging. So that's one of the positives for me, or one of the things that I am very happy about going into this World Cup, is that we now have Mazraoui at Bayern Munich coming back into the team. You know, in the last couple of friendlies, we have been playing with a four at the back formation. So we play a 4-3-3, and it's basically, the coach said in a press conference that he wanted to use both Mazraoui and Hakimi, who are originally right backs, both of them. And he had asked them, you know, are any of you comfortable with playing on the left? And Mazraoui was the one that said, yeah, I can try and see how it goes. So Lucero Mazraoui is the one who is probably going to be playing at left back, and then Hakimi on the right, which gives us two, you know, great international level fullbacks, which will provide threats on both sides. So I think that will make us a little bit more unpredictable, because, you know, previously it's been all about that right side and trying to get crosses from that part of the pitch. But now we have Hakimi on the right, and we also have Mazraoui cutting inside, you know, and even, you know, joining in into the box when we have crosses. So I think it's crucial for us to have a threat offensively on both fullbacks.
I get a sense of excitement from you, from Adam as well. I wanted to ask Lover a little bit of a similar question to what Joe asked Adam previously in terms of what is really the morale at this point? Is there a similar type excitement? Because obviously Croatia reached the final in the last World Cup. I think the expectations of the four teams in this group are highest for Croatia. I sense a little bit more of a business-like approach where we've been to the final. We're going to go far in this tournament. Let's put our heads down and focus, and how do we get there? Is that reasonable, or is there more joy, excitement, very much looking forward to just all of the atmosphere and positives that relate to the World Cup?
There is, as I said, there are huge expectations from a lot of people are expecting, as I said, at least a quarterfinal finish, but it is going to be tough as we are facing either Germany or Spain, most likely, unless Japan or Costa Rica pull off some kind of miracle. But the morale of the team is definitely high. All the players are performing very well at their clubs. Modric especially is still playing at a high level at Real Madrid. It's just fascinating every time I watch him for Croatia or for Real Madrid. And then you have players who have been starting games instead of, for example, Josip Šutalo, who is playing at Dinamo Zagreb, is potentially a replacement for either Lovren or Vida. That's a huge ask for Dalic in terms of positions. But just the feeling ahead of the World Cup is amazing. Everybody's just waiting for it. I've been waiting for the last month. I've been playing Waka Waka. I've just been playing World Cup songs just to get myself in the mood, because it's yes. It's not the usual thing. It's not, oh, here's the summer, here's the World Cup, it's the winter. Yeah. I'm in school. Yeah. It's not that feeling. So you kind of have to prep yourself for it. But the players are some players are definitely gonna be a bit exhausted, but I think just because of they're representing Croatia. You're representing a runner-up from the last World Cup. Everybody's going to be up for it, and I think the players are definitely up for it, and especially the young ones. The young ones are going to have to want to prove themselves. Especially some had questionable performances at the Euros, so I think most of them will definitely want to prove themselves and show themselves to the world.
And I wanted to ask also, because Croatia's only lost once in their last 15 matches, so obviously a team that's playing really well. The one thing that sticks out a little bit for me as a possible weak point is scoring goals and where they're going to come from. And you look up and down the roster at the international success that the players have had, and there are only three players who've scored 10 goals for the national team. And obviously that's still a tremendous accomplishment, but it's Luka Modric, Perisic, and Kramaric, and they're 37, 33, and 31, respectively. So does scoring goals concern you? Do you expect the similar players to really lead the team, or do you think there could be some newer players that are going to have an impact scoring goals the World Cup?
So, as I said before, the striker position is a problem after Mandžukić. In our Euro qualifiers, we had Petkovic, who was in really good form. He scored, he assisted, especially I remember a game against Hungary where he scored a goal with the back heel, and everyone was like, this is the replacement. We immediately found him a year later. Then last year in 2020, he wasn't in good form. So then we were scrambling. Kramaric is good. Kramaric is a very good striker at Hoffenheim, but in our system, we need somebody that's tall, that can play the ball. But Kramaric is more of a, let's say, a selfish player, and he shoots when he sees the opportunity. But he's not the type of player for our tactical style. And just that striker position that Mandžukić played was perfect. And then this year we had Petkovic, who's getting back into form. Today he assisted and scored for Dinamo in their league match against Šibenik. And then we have a new face, let's say, Marko Livaja, who's playing at Hajduk, a rival to Dinamo Zagreb. He's currently first in the Hajnal for goals and for assists. And the last time he played, he went on for Budimir in the game against Austria and gave us the lead. Scored a header, very niche header, scored a brilliant, brilliant player. He's brilliant playing with his back. So he can take a beating. He can pass the ball. He has the vision. He's very creative, similar type to Petkovic, but I think he's just a little bit better to Petkovic, because I am, as you can see, a Hajduk fan. So, the problem is the striker position, because you have Budimir, who's really tall. He's very good at scoring goals with his head, but he's more of a, let's say, a Peter Crouch type, a Brexit kind of striker that's tall. You just want to whip crosses into, but we don't play that way. You need somebody that can play with his back to goal, that can assist, that can combine with the wingers, with the midfielders. But then you have the problem of Kramaric, who is the best striker, I'd say. When you see the list of the strikers, you're like, Kramaric is the one that has to start, but sadly, that's not him. And then you have Colak now, who's been perfect this season at Rangers, he's scored a lot of times, so he's definitely added extra headaches to Dalic to see who's going to start the game. I don't know who's going to start the game against Morocco, and we have a friendly against Saudi Arabia coming up soon, so we're going to have to see how it goes there, but definitely there is a bit of a problem with scoring. So hopefully we pick the right person who's really up for it, but I think everybody's going to be up for it, but it's just about that. Who fits the style most?
So I wanted to ask the group about predictions, and we've talked a lot about the players, some of the things that are going well, some of the things that aren't going so well, but ultimately we're going to see what happens. And to Adam's point earlier, anything can happen and it's all speculation until then, but we're going to ask you for predictions. And so, Elliot, I'm going to start with you. What do you think is going to happen in this group? Which two teams do you think are going to ultimately advance? And then who do you think is going to win the World Cup?
Yes, I think Belgium still, their quality will shine through, I think. We're focused mainly on this podcast on the things that might be doubts with the Belgian team. But let's just remember also that the Belgian team is still very good. We have arguably the best goalkeeper in the world in Thibaut Courtois, arguably the best midfielder in the world. I know Lovren might think otherwise, but in Kevin De Bruyne, Luka Modric is up there as well, obviously. And then we have Romelu Lukaku, who, if he remains fit, is probably one of the best strikers in the world when it comes to the national team. In his last 50 appearances for Belgium, he has 57 goals and 12 assists, which is quite remarkable. So there are still a lot of positives. A lot of players are playing very good for their respective clubs at the moment. You see, De Bruyne is, as always, amazing. Courtois is very good. Players like Leandro Trossard, who might get a chance in this World Cup, playing very good for Brighton. So there is optimism as well. It's not just doom and gloom in Belgium. So I think Belgium will ultimately go through. Whether they'll finish first or second, it's difficult to predict. I think Croatia is obviously a very tough opponent. I don't think it's... I can't imagine there has ever been a group with two reigning medalists in the World Cup. It's the second and third place team from last time out. I have to say, with all due respect, I think Belgium will beat Morocco and Canada, but I don't think it's going to be as easy as some may think. There are teams that we mentioned that are on an upwards trajectory. Belgium, maybe not so much. But I think Belgium and Croatia will go through this group. And then ultimately, I don't think Belgium has what it takes to win the entire thing. You've seen two tournaments in a row. We've lost to the eventual winners in France and Italy. And it's both times it's come off the back of a tough, difficult game. We won against Brazil, but then lost against France. We won against Portugal, then lost to Italy. I think Belgium lacks the depth in the squad, which means that when we have a tough game and we have to play the same players because our depth isn't great and they are tired, we then get knocked out. And I think the first knockout round is going to be very tough with either Spain or Germany probably. And even if we then manage to beat them, I think in the quarterfinals we'll have huge problems. And for a question, who's going to win the entire thing? I think it's very difficult to predict. I think I said this at the last tournament as well. Obviously, it didn't happen, but I think Brazil has a great shot. They've had a very impressive qualifying campaign as well. So I think you'd be stupid to overlook Brazil as one of the options.
Totally agree. Joe, I'm going to go to you next. What do you expect to happen in this group?
Okay, that was a good shout from Elliot about Trossard, by the way. I totally forgot. totally forgot about him. And yeah, he's on a really good form, so that's a good shout. That being said, you guys have all made very convincing arguments, so I truly have no idea who's going to take this group. Okay, so my heart really wants Canada to get out of this group, but my head says I just think it's going to be too tough. So,
Joe, I'm going to give you honorary citizenship right now. Thank you. You just summarized the country perfectly. You are Canadian, though.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Wait until I make my picks.
I've only ever been to Toronto, but it was a good time. So I'm going to say Croatia is going to take first, and I'm going to say Morocco in second. And that's really tough. I don't really have a whole lot to back it up. That's just kind of what I want, honestly. nothing against, you know, Belgium or Canada. It's just, yeah, I kind of have a thing for Morocco if you listen to the show. So I'm excited that, you know, that they're back and you know, for a second time running. And yeah, I think Croatia is on really, really good form right now. They're kind of my dark horse pick to win the whole thing. Which I don't know how much of a dark horse that is, but you know, they're in really good form, and I think there's something to that. So yeah, I'm going to say Croatia and Morocco get out of the group.
Benjo, what do you think of Joe's pick?
Yeah, well, I really appreciate the optimism, Joe. I wasn't expecting that. I was about to challenge you on who you thought would become third of Canada and Morocco before you said that Morocco would finish second. So I'm glad you have high hopes for Morocco. For me, it's a bit of a divided one. I think I've been thinking about this earlier, and as a betting man, if I was a betting man and I had to put money on two teams to go through, I think it would be very hard to look past Croatia and Belgium. You know, you put the two teams together or up against each other. You know, if you put Morocco up against Croatia, or put them up against Belgium, we are big underdogs. We have to admit that. But as we've seen in big tournaments before, a lot can happen. And I think Adam said it perfectly about the schedule. I think the schedule is very important for me as well. I was in the previous World Cup in 2018. I was very upset about the fact that we were in a group with Spain, Portugal, and Iran. And we started off against Iran, and that was to me that was very annoying, because I always have the impression that the bigger teams tend to slip up in the opening round, because they, you know, that's at the point where they still they can still, you know, manage to go through. It's not the end of the world if you lose your opening game. I remember Spain, especially in 2010, I think, when they won the World Cup. Where they lost to Switzerland in the opening match, and then, you know, went on to win. So for the big sides like Croatia and Belgium, it's not the end of the world if they lose to a Morocco or a Canada in the opening match, because they can still they can still fix things in the latter game weeks. But for Morocco and Canada, I think it's crucial to not get off to a losing start. And I think we have higher chances of going through when we play a Croatia. Like Lobo said, high expectations now into 2022 compared to 4 years ago. So, you know, the Croatian have all the pressure, and we can go in as underdogs and maybe cause an upset. And then it will be, could potentially be a decisive match in the third game against Canada. Maybe Morocco can go in there with at least a point, you know, maybe 3 points going into the third game against Canada. And then we have everything to play for. So my heart says second place, but as I said, if I was to put money on the group, I would have to go with Croatia and Belgium. And I think Elliot's very good points about Brazil as the winners. I think one of the South American teams, Brazil and Argentina, I think they have the right, you know, the right squad, the right generation, the right hunger, the right form going into this. This World Cup. So that's my prediction.
All right. Adam, not a lot of optimism about Canada yet. Do you agree with that, or do you think Canada can get out of this group?
Well, see, you just asked me two different questions, Brandon.
I did.
Do I agree and do I think? Those are two very different. like, this is cheating because I don't do predictions generally. Doing play-by-play kills predictions for me. I also don't bet on football since Messi broke my heart in the 97th minute against the Iran a couple of World Cups ago. I lost, like, I didn't lose the money, but I would have won like $800 from him, and he scored stupid. It doesn't matter. So predictions aren't really my forte. I will predict this. The Canada-Belgium first game will feature the two worst shirts and kits in the World Cup. Belgium with the fire clip art on their sleeve. What in the world is that? And Canada's white t-shirt with the swoosh. So I know that I'm confident in that prediction. I think one of Croatia or Belgium gets through and one of Morocco or Canada. I don't think that both of the quote-unquote favorites go. I just think this one's too wide open. I think everybody wins a game. I don't know that anybody even wins two. So I think this is going to be very, very tight. And the draws and the matches you do slip up in, it can't be a blowout because I think goal differential might actually matter in this group. I think if Canada can beat Belgium in the first game, they can sneak into that second. And then I would see a Croatia and then whoever wins Canada-Morocco. I know I'm just dodging this question a lot because I really don't know. But let's say Croatia, Canada, Belgium. No. See, I'm already doing this again. Croatia, Canada, Belgium, Morocco is going to be my final answer. And I think I agree with the South Americans' time to win it all. I would say Argentina, let Messi have his flowers.
All right, Lovery, what are your picks for this group?
I don't like to do predictions because most of the ones I do are wrong. So when it comes to these tournaments, I like to do one from the heart and one from the from the brain. But the brain says it will get through as second. The first place is Belgium or Morocco. Morocco looks really good to me, just because the quality is there. You have players that are playing at the top five leagues, all of them. So it's really, they look really promising. Then you have Belgium. Their defense, as Elliot has said, is a bit shaky. But at the end of the day, you have KDB. And you have Lukaku, and we played Belgium in our friendly before the Euros last year, which we lost 1-0, and we didn't look that good. But I think now, when that team was half of the squad that it is now, but I think we'll beat Belgium. But that game, that first game against Morocco is really important for us. That is gonna be, if we lose that, we're gonna be plummet down back to the ground. From our high expectations, then it'll be like, okay, we have to save this. So yeah, I think we'll finish second behind. I'll save Morocco. Let's give Morocco kind of really big surprise in first place, and then Belgium and then Canada. But my heart says we'll finish first. Belgium will finish second, and then Canada. Let's give Canada the third place and Morocco fourth, kind of from my heart.
All right, and who do you like to win the whole thing?
As I said, South America, as everybody said. I've been saying it for the last 5 months. It's really the time. And now seeing Messi and what form he is, and Neymar, it's hard to look past Brazil and Argentina.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot more optimism about the South American teams and a little bit less so about the European teams heading into this tournament. So Brazil and Argentina are certainly very popular picks. I'm actually going to be at the Canada versus Morocco match, the final group stage match. So I will be there. I'm really looking forward to it. This group is so strong. And you look at all four of these teams. Canada finished first in CONCACAF qualifying. Morocco, you could easily say, is the best team in Africa, or certainly right up there among with Senegal. Belgium, in our We Global Football rankings, is the highest ranking European team, even still. And Croatia just finished second over in the overall table in the UEFA Nations League. So you look at all four of these teams, and they're really strong. And I am going to pick Belgium first and Croatia second. But I do think that this is a group where ultimately one of those two does not make it. I totally agree with what Adam was saying. It feels like something is going to happen in this group where one of Belgium or Croatia, or maybe even both, but at least one of Belgium or Croatia will not make it through. And I certainly think all four of these teams, Canada, Morocco, Belgium, and Croatia, can can go through to the round of 16. So I'm going to stick with Belgium and Croatia, but I would not be surprised at all to see an upset here. So,
Brandon, can we imagine a world for 1 second where Canada and Morocco get out of this group? I think Europe would just like
crumble.
We will crumble. Yeah.
My goodness.
Well, it's to your point. You said if Canada defeats Belgium in the first match, Lovry had a shred of doubt. If Morocco beats them, Canada versus Morocco could be for first in the group, and not to see who actually gets through. So
if the European sides both lose their first game, the meme you're going to see on Twitter the most coming out of North America is just stop the count.
Yeah.
It's not going to stop if that does happen.
But this is a great group because it's, I don't know how many other groups you can really just say that and think about what if this, what if that, and it's not impossible. It's not impossible, and we'll see what happens when we get to Qatar.
Just make sure you wear red to your game, Brandon.
I will wear red. All right. Well, we wanted to thank all of our guests again, Lovry, Elliot, Adam, Benja. Thank you so much for joining us and talking through Group F with us. It's been a lot of fun, and we're really looking forward to seeing what happens in Group F in Qatar. For the listeners as well, give us a follow at Window INTL Pod. You can follow myself, Brandon, at @we_global, We Global Football, International Football Statistics, Rankings, Projections, all that sort of thing. And Joe at 12th Yank on Twitter as well. So thank you all for listening and joining us today, and hope you enjoyed the Group F.